Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to episode number 228 of Real Life Ghost Stories. And to kick things off this week, I would like to say thanks to some of our newest Patreon subscribers. I would like to thank Poppy Linsky, Meredith Deckert, Cassie Erskine, and Alice Robinson. Thank you so much for subscribing to the Patreon. I love you and appreciate you every single day. And our film review this week. Our film review is Imaginary. Imaginary was released in 2024. It has 4.9 out of 10 on IMDb and 28% on Rotten Tomatoes. From Blumhouse, the genre-defying masterminds behind Five Nights at Freddy's and Megan, comes an original horror that taps into the innocence of imaginary friends and begs the question, are they really figments of childhood imagination or is something more terrifying lying just beneath? When Jessica moves back into her childhood home with her family, her youngest stepdaughter, Alice, develops an eerie attachment to a stuffed bear named Chauncey that she finds in the basement. Alice starts playing games with Chauncey that begin playfully and become increasingly sinister. As Alice's behaviour becomes more and more concerning, Jessica intervenes only to realise that Chauncey is much more than the stuffed toy bear she believed him to be. I will say that at the time of recording, it was 4.9 out of 10 on IMDb and 28% on Rotten Tomatoes. But for new films, that changes really rapidly. So that might have changed already by the time this actually is released. So I went to see this film on a whim. I hadn't planned it and deeply regretted it. That's a bit mean. Did I deeply regret it? I don't know. So let's be fair to this film. And we're going to start off with the likes. The protagonist, Jessica, has lovely outfits. Really, really lovely outfits. Lovely, flowy, beautiful trousers. God, you're really scraping the barrel when you're saying she has lovely outfits. I did think, though, in the horror film world, or in the film world in general, why is nobody lounging around in leggings and a big hoodie? Do you know what I mean? Especially when you have a deadline. When I have a deadline and I have something that I need to do, you best believe I'm sitting in my pajamas and doing it. I feel like, God, is everybody else put together when you're working from home? Or are you like me and sort of lounging around, rolling around, covered in, I don't know, crisp dust? That's what I feel like I'm like. But clearly in horror movie world, that's not the thing. But her outfits were divine. They were very, very nice. I did genuinely think that the film used children's games and silliness really effectively for scares. So, for example, there's a moment in the film where Jessica, her partner, and the youngest stepdaughter, they are all hiding under the covers playing this hiding game. And I thought, you know what, that this is freaky. This is scary. Like, this is making me feel tense, you know? And there's that beautiful dichotomy between the innocence of children's games and the sort of horror of this imaginary friend Chauncey and what Chauncey is capable of. And I did think as well, there's a freaky basement in this film. We're not even going to go into the old adage of don't go down into the basement or some demon is going to eat your face off. We all know that adage. But, you know, the basement scenes I thought were done very well, genuinely. You know, anytime anybody went down into the basement, there was... I'm just going to say it. I'm sorry if this is a spoiler alert for anybody, but whatever. I don't care anymore. There's the dark shadow in the background and it's just sort of there at various points in the house, but particularly in the basement. And you only really notice it when it like flexes or it turns its head And I thought, that's good. That's effective. You're not showing off the monster or whatever it was really quickly. And you are using something that is really effectively terrifying. That something is genuinely lurking in the shadows. You know, that's a very primal fear, that something is lurking in the shadows. I did think as well, there was a really simple and effective use of toys throughout the film for scares. Like the bear was used for scares. There was various other children's toys, like this merry-go-round light up thingy was used. The string pull mechanism on the bear was used really well for scares. And I, you know, they were simple scares. And I respect and appreciate a simple scare, a simple technique that really does make you feel tense. There were a couple of jump scares, and I'm not a big fan of jump scares in films, but these jump scares were effective because they were relevant, you know? And you find out throughout the film that the youngest child has been regularly seeing a psychologist. And the reason she's been seeing a psychologist is because her biological mother has severe mental health issues and burned the child. And the child, Alice, has been, you know, receiving ongoing help from mental professionals to work through this particular trauma. And when they realise that this imaginary friend situation might be a little bit grim and a little bit dark, they bring in a psychologist to see her. And you get this great moment where she's being filmed by the psychologist, and the psychologist is talking to her about this imaginary friend. And I thought it was really, I thought it was tense. You know, I thought it was really good. And that's where I thought this film was going. I thought it was going to go down like the psychology route, and the psychologist realizing that, oh my God, this actually might not be a psychological issue. This might be something more dramatic than that. But the psychologist just goes, oh yeah, God, this is wild. Yeah, weird. Some weird shit is happening here. I'm off. See you later. So I do genuinely think the film had tense and scary moments, and I think it had promise. But my God, was the last 45 minutes possibly the worst 45 minutes of a horror film that I've ever seen. So we're going to pivot into the dislikes column. Firstly, I have a little pet peeve about films when nobody in the film world seems to know what social media looks like. We all know what TikTok, Instagram, Snapchat, we know what they look like. I don't know why they always do them so badly in films. That's a very small pet peeve, but it just really annoys me. I am really bored of the moody teenager trope. It really annoys me. It's overdone. I just find it annoying. And I thought the story was really obvious. I'm pretty sure I could map out the story from start to finish, aside from the absurdity of the last 45 minutes. There wasn't really anything shocking about the film. I did think, like I said, when the psychologist got involved, that we were going down a promising road, but we did not. That was just a dead end. And obviously the story centers around this little girl called Alice, who is a very good actor. And there was a point where they start using a sort of slightly distorted version of Alice's voice for the entity, and it just sounded ridiculous. It just didn't work. It wasn't frightening. It didn't have the impact that I think they were going for. It just sounded silly, and I sort of was sniggering a bit every time the entity started talking in Alice's voice. I did make lots of notes about little things that annoyed me in the film, like generally in horror films when somebody goes missing and people, when they're looking for them, they just sort of stand in the middle of the room and shout their name. Really annoys me. They just go from room to room, just standing in the middle of the room, repeatedly shouting the person's name. I just think, look better, look harder, look under things, pick up a cushion, do something. And I genuinely thought the ending was the most absurd piece of cinema I've seen in a really long time. And that is not me being hyperbolic. I honestly was sitting with my mouth open watching the ending play out. So, you know, this is a slight spoiler alert. I mean, it's never going to give away how bonkers it actually is. But at the end of Insidious, I feel like the film Insidious is absolutely ruined by the ending where they end up in the demon's weird workshop. Because I always think it's so bizarre. They've done the same thing in this film, but really amped it. Like it genuinely lasts about half an hour to 45 minutes. Where they end up in this just this absurd world of the entity. And I hate to say it, but this attempt to have the characters in the film put into this world of the entity and trying to run around in this, I don't know, fucking imaginary world of the entity and trying to rescue people and whatever, it genuinely completely took away from any previous craft that the film had done. And I really think that the beginning of the film and the first half of the film, I thought they had crafted the story well. Even though the story was obvious, it didn't matter. I was still freaked by various parts of it, genuinely. It did feel like the end of the film was a joke, that I wasn't in on the punchline, you know, that I didn't really understand what was happening. And I read in a review somewhere else that somebody had said that the filmmakers spent so much time trying to world build that they just completely forgot they were making a horror film. And honestly, that's what it felt like. I could rant about this film all day, but it wasn't for me. It was fun. It was genuinely fun. The first half I really thought was good and going places. There were some questionable choices, but nothing that I thought was, you know, dire. And then we got into that ending and it all fell apart spectacularly. I'm going to give it 2 stars. And those 2 stars are for the first half. And it loses 3 stars for the ending of the film. And I feel like I want that 45 minutes of my life back. So if you are somebody from Blumhouse, I don't know, up your game. You're very touch and go.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Which brings us to our story this week. And our story this week is something that I am incredibly excited about. I've wanted to talk about Appalachian horror stories for years. And I sort of always stayed away from it because I was a little bit afraid of the magnitude of stories that come from the Appalachian Mountains. I can already hear people typing, but I'm going to ask you to pause for a second before you hit send, angrily telling me that it's Appalachian. So I did look this up on the Appalachian Today website, which is the Appalachian State University website. And they say that obviously, there is a preference that some people say Appalachian and some people say Appalachian, and that generally it depends on where you grew up. So if you grew up near southern Appalachia, you say Appalachian. But if you grow up in the north or other regions, then you will probably say Appalachian. And that website recommended that if you are an outsider, it is probably recommended to say Appalachian. So I'm going to say Appalachian for the purpose of this episode. And for this episode too, I'm dealing with real life, real world people's stories. And there will be probably quite a number of Appalachian stories because there's so many different entities, cryptids, legends, folklore, myth. There's just a whole wealth of it. So for today, we are starting with a very brief history of the Appalachian Mountains, some brief look at the folklore and superstitions, and then some real people's experiences. So let's get into it. Never close a knife you didn't open, or you'll have bad luck for 7 years. Keep a penny in your washer. Always go out the same door that you came in. Eat black-eyed peas or collard greens with hog jaw on New Year's Day. Don't wash clothes on New Year's Day, or you will wash a family member out. Don't sleep on New Year's. Don't do any canning or gardening on your period. Plant your crops under the full moon. Don't walk under a ladder. If you find yourself under one, don't turn around. Back up. Don't let anyone sweep under your feet. Never give someone a set of knives as a gift. If you give them to newlyweds, it will cut their love. If a black cat crosses your path, turn and go a different way. Never repay salt that you have borrowed. If a bad storm is coming, put a two-edged axe into a stump facing the storm to ensure that the storm goes around you. If you spill salt, throw a pinch over your left shoulder so you won't have bad luck. When you drop your fork, it means a woman is coming to visit. If you drop a knife, a man is coming to visit. Don't cut your baby's hair before their first birthday. Your baby has to fall off the bed before their first birthday. Run a chicken over your baby to keep it from getting chickenpox. Don't let a pregnant woman see a dead person or the baby will have a birthmark. If cows are laying down or leaves are upside down, it's going to rain. Hang a horseshoe upside down to keep good luck from running out. Wear a buckeye in your bra to ward off rheumatism. Hold your breath when you pass a cemetery, or you'll be the next to die. If you see a white horse, you'll have good luck. Hold your feet up when you're crossing a railroad track, or you'll lose your boyfriend. If you're walking with someone, you have to go on the same side of a post or obstacle, or it will break your friendship. Don't wash clothes on a Sunday. If your nose is itching, it means company is coming. Open the window when someone dies and cover the mirrors so that their soul can leave. Hang a mirror by the door to protect against evil. Never leave a rocking chair rocking, or you will invite spirits. The Appalachian Mountains, often referred to as the Appalachians, stretch over 1,500 miles from the Canadian province of Newfoundland to central Alabama in the southeastern United States. This ancient mountain range is one of the oldest on Earth, formed approximately 480 million years ago through a series of tectonic collisions and volcanic activity. Over eons, the Appalachians have undergone significant geological changes, including erosion, glaciation, and uplift. The region has been home to various indigenous peoples for thousands of years. These indigenous groups, including the Cherokee, Shawnee, and Iroquois, established rich cultures and traditions within the Appalachian region long before the arrival of European settlers. European exploration of the Appalachians began in the late 16th century, when Spanish, French, and English explorers ventured into the area in search of resources and trade routes. However, it wasn't until the early 18th century that European settlement in the region began in earnest. Settlers primarily of Scottish, Irish, English, and German descent moved into the valleys and foothills of the mountains, establishing farms, towns, and communities. Throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, the Appalachians became a frontier region marked by conflict, as settlers clashed with indigenous peoples and with each other over land, resources, and political allegiance. The mountains also served as a refuge for outlaws and fugitives seeking to evade law enforcement. During the 19th century, the Appalachian region experienced significant industrialization, particularly in the extraction of coal, timber, and other natural resources. This led to the development of mining towns and the expansion of railroads throughout the mountains. The exploitation of the region's resources brought both prosperity and environmental degradation, leading to conflicts between labor and management, as well as efforts to conserve the natural beauty of the Appalachians. In the 20th century, the Appalachian region faced economic challenges as industries declined, leading to widespread poverty and out-migration. Efforts to revitalise the region's economy have been ongoing, including the promotion of tourism, outdoor recreation and sustainable development initiatives. The Appalachian region is steeped in rich folklore and superstitions, passed down through generations of settlers and indigenous peoples. These traditions reflect a blend of European, African and Native American influences, creating a unique cultural tapestry. One prevalent belief among Appalachian people is the existence of supernatural beings such as ghosts, witches and haints. Stories of haunted houses, restless spirits and mysterious disappearances are common throughout the region. Many families have their own tales of encounters with the paranormal, often recounted around the hearth on long winter nights. The Appalachian Mountains are also home to various creatures, including the infamous Mothman of West Virginia, a winged humanoid said to inhabit the area around Point Pleasant. Other legendary creatures include Bigfoot, the Cherokee Little People, and the Snallygaster, a dragon-like beast said to terrorize the Maryland countryside. Superstitions surrounding luck, love, and protection are prevalent in Appalachian folklore. For example, hanging horseshoes above the doorway is believed to bring good fortune, while placing a broom behind the door wards off evil spirits. Many Appalachian families also practice folk magic, using herbs, charms, and incantations for healing, protection, and luck. The mountains themselves are imbued with mystical significance, with certain locations believed to possess supernatural powers or spiritual significance, sacred springs, enchanted forests, and mysterious rock formations dot the landscape, serving as focal points for rituals, ceremonies, and gatherings. Despite modernization and changes in societal beliefs, Appalachian folklore continues to thrive, preserved by oral tradition and passed down through storytelling, music, and art. These rich traditions serve as a source of cultural identity and community cohesion, connecting Appalachian people to their shared history and the natural world around them. This is likely going to be the first of many episodes of Appalachian stories and folklore. And for the first dive into the stories of the mountains, we will be looking at five true stories of people's experiences in the Appalachians. And the first story comes from the Reddit user Zimby. This happened to me when I went backpacking on the Appalachian Trail a few summers ago. We woke up in the morning early, got out of our tents, and there was a dense mist all around us. About the time we had packed up the tents and started walking back to the main trail, we started hearing little kids laughing. I didn't react for a while because I thought I was hearing things and because no one else seemed to notice. This line of kids and one parent came out of nowhere, walking diagonal to the trail. They kept laughing in this creepy way. This was early in the morning on a mountain, relatively far from other human beings. One of the kids asks us, "Where are you going?" And someone in our group responds, "We're hiking on the Appalachian Trail." The kid says, "This isn't the Appalachian Trail." And they start laughing again. They continued diagonal to the trail and disappeared into the mist again, but for the rest of the morning we could hear them laughing. It was pretty creepy. Okay, right. Before we dive into terrifying children giggling in the middle of the wilderness, I loved this list of Appalachian superstitions. And I think sometimes I forget that, you know, these superstitions traveled from places like Ireland, Scotland and England. So a lot of those superstitions are similar to ones that are still held in Ireland. And I'm sure in other places, like, it still blows my mind, for example, that people from Newfoundland, I'm making a conscious effort to say Newfoundland properly and not Newfoundland. But it always blows my mind that people in Newfoundland use a lot of Irishisms and often have what sound like really strong Irish accents. So things like don't wash your clothes on New Year's Day or you'll wash a family member out. Love that one. I'm going to take on board the don't do any canning or gardening on your period. Not that I would do either, but just in case anybody expects me to do either of those things, I'm just going to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. I'm on my period and I will either die or get bad luck if I do it. My absolute favorite one, I think, is the putting a two-edged axe facing a storm to ensure the storm is split in two and goes around you. I think that's so interesting and just fascinating. We also believed growing up that, you know, when cows are laying down, it means that it's going to rain. And we believed that if you're walking with someone and you have to go around an obstacle, that you can't split the obstacle or it'll break your friendship. We believed that one too. I just love that those cultural little nuances are the same across the water. I just think it's fascinating. And the history of the Appalachian Mountains is pretty incredible. Like, obviously, that's only a tiny little brief glimpse at the history that I gave. And so you've got all of this indigenous history and indigenous folklore, and then the mix of different cultures and traditions and beliefs and rituals that all got mixed up together when colonization happened. It's just incredible. But I mean, trekking away in the mountains and hearing children laughing all around you and having children skipping through the forest with an adult and telling you, this isn't the Appalachian Trail. That's horrifying. I think it's even scarier if they're not ghosts or supernatural entities. If they're real people skipping around in the mountains, go away or just be less terrifying. And if that's the case, if these are real people, did they just stay skipping around, those hikers, just out of view in the mist all morning, given the fact that they could still hear them laughing? And if it's a supernatural entity, what is it? Is it some sort of fey folk? Are they ghosts? Because I just get the feeling that they're actually real people rather than it being anything supernatural. And honestly, I do think that's worse. And the second story comes from a forum called whiteblaze.net. And just to say that all of the links to all of the stories are in the description of this episode. I've always thought that there were logical or scientific answers for all of these paranormal phenomena, and probably always would have, if not for the two nights I spent at Pierce Pond in June. Both nights were exquisite in temperature and weather, and no bugs, which at the time I found quite odd. In hindsight, it seems important. I was alone, had a great campfire, and played my harmonica and sang the first night. As the embers dimmed, I sat on the edge of the lean-to, writing in my journal as the night sounds started to get my attention. They were just different, and I knew someone or something was about. I could feel it. Through the moonlight, I could see something that kind of took me aback, and I sat still as possible while trying to slouch into my sleeping bag. There is no doubt it was a figure that was moving across my sight between me and the pond. It was definitely the form of a spectral, woodsy, outdoorsman type with a small pack and what appeared to be fishing gear. The figure faded into the night, and I woke refreshed and relieved to be on the trail in such a beautiful location. I thought about heading out as my first experience like this had me unnerved. But the day was beautiful, and I mostly forgot about it as I stayed on to enjoy another day. But as my campfire lit the trees around me that night, this same woodsy character reappeared. And as the fire crackled, its eyes turned towards me. And I was truly frightened for the first time in my life. And I ran up the hill away from the lean-to, and I didn't stop till I could barely breathe. I finally had to slump down next to a tree and wait for morning. When daylight came, I found my way back to the lean-to, packed up, and went to Tim's for pancakes and told him of what I had seen. He'd heard of this too. It seems for years this vision has been haunting a wide area of Maine, although he was unsure if it had ever caused any trouble. I think that's one of the things about these stories that is so unnerving, is this sense of just complete isolation. And although that's a really beautiful thing when you're in the middle of nowhere and you are feeling more settled with nature and the world is just existing around you and there's no hustle and bustle. And, you know, like this poster said, they were playing their harmonica and singing and writing in their journal. What a lovely way to spend some time. The weather was perfect. I'm sure there was a great sense of calm and stillness and just being at one with nature. And then all of a sudden, you're seeing this spectral outdoorsman knocking around, That sense of isolation and the idea that somebody else is in your space would absolutely petrify me, because I'd be thinking, if you're a real person, are you going to cause me harm? Because it's just the two of us out here. Things could go terribly wrong very quickly. And for lots of people, that wilderness is home and was home for generations of people. People who worked really hard and toiled the land and lived off the forest and lived off the mountains. So it kind of, you can understand why these spectral images would still be there. This residual energy reliving things that they lived in their day-to-day life. However, this particular story would suggest that that figure saw him. That figure saw this hiker. And it continually makes me think about timelines and multiverses, and are we seeing ghosts, or are we just seeing different timelines for a brief moment? I can't think about it too much because it genuinely hurts my brain. And the third story comes from Willow Studios, and this comes from yourghoststories.com. When I was younger, about 8, I saw my first ghost. We were hiking in the Appalachian Mountains, backcountry camping. I was terrified about sleeping in the woods near the top of a mountain, but my mother said we would be just fine. Animals are terrified of daddy, my mother said with a teasing tone. Holding my mother's hand, I trusted her, but I was still nervous. We hiked up along the Appalachian Trail until my father decided it was time to settle down and set up camp. We found a nice clearing. The sun was setting. I looked up to my mother to notice that she was pale, and her hand was tightly grasping mine. Todd, can we set up camp somewhere different? My mother asked, still clutching my tiny hand. She was not liking the vibe the woods were giving. I sensed it too. I was afraid. My father shook his head. It's getting late. I'm not searching for firewood in the dark. I remember asking to go home. The small clearing seemed to give an ominous vibe. After hot dogs and marshmallows, we crawled into the 6-person tent my father had purchased. My father fell asleep in mere minutes, but my mother and I could not sleep. Emma, are you asleep? I lifted my head. No, Mama, I'm scared. I can't sleep. Hush, it's fine. We're safe inside the tent, she comforted. I finally fell asleep and woke up in the early hours of the morning. I came out of the tent and saw my mother sitting on the ground, meditating. She meditated every morning with a cup of Earl Grey tea. I came up to her and tapped her on the shoulder. Mama, can we take a walk? Mother opened her eyes and got to her feet. Sure, let's not go far. I don't want Daddy to worry. We hiked near our campsite when my mother suddenly stopped. I followed her gaze to see a hazy image of a man leaning against a birch tree about 20 feet away. He was just a hazy image, but he did not seem threatening, just calm and solemn. He lifted his head and looked in our direction. I rubbed my eyes and he was gone. My mother just looked at me and I understood that the man was not threatening, just calm and sad. After that, I've never seen a ghost, but I will never forget him. Never. Again, there seems to be another indication that these aren't just residual energies, that this particular spirit entity, this hazy image of a man, saw this mother and daughter, that he was able to see them. And it does make me think about, you know, how many people over the centuries, over the generations, have been secretly bopping around in those forests, have been secretly bopping around in those mountains, like people who've decided to live off grid, people who have decided that they need to flee to the mountains for whatever reason. There's got to be loads of people that have lived and died in those forested mountainous regions that people don't even know about. And like I said, for so many people, the mountains and the forests would have been very important places, maybe even sacred spaces. So it makes sense that their spirit would hang around. But what if it's to do with energy? What if it's to do with the energy of the mountain? That the energy of the mountain is so strong that it allows for people to see through time and space. But what if it allows for these tiny rips in time, and what people are seeing isn't necessarily ghosts, but people from another timeline? I feel like I need my tinfoil hat for this episode. Lots of people tagged me in a TikTok where this girl was positing that maybe that is what ghosts are, that we're not seeing ghosts. We're seeing tiny rips in the space-time continuum, and we are seeing different timelines, or we are seeing, you know, the past or the future, or we're seeing different universes. I don't know. And it's really got my head all in a spin. And the fourth story comes from a user called Brad Lane on a website called BlueRidgeOutdoors.com. It's taken some time for me to even process the events in my own head. But just of late, I've been able to think about this weird thing that happened to me on a trail sometime in late August or early September. I had a random week off work, and keeping a busy schedule, I felt it was a rarity. I was getting a little restless and knew I had to blow off some steam for a bit and explore the great outdoors. On the account that I was so ready for a vacation and no one else's schedule matched up for an adventure week, I decided to go at it solo and backpack alone for a week. It had been years since I last backpacked alone, and for some reason I had convinced myself I once enjoyed it. But when I dropped my car at the trailhead about 15 miles from Newcastle and started hiking, I noticed the different atmosphere backpacking alone provides. I couldn't shake how incredibly silent it was. I could hear my own breathing, and every now and then I would look over my shoulder quickly in response to random noises. I was almost anxious to begin with, but told myself I just had to get used to this new aspect of backpacking that I wasn't accustomed to. The first night I managed to set up camp, make dinner, and immediately retire to my tent. I was unusually exhausted, which now seems a surprise for the little sleep that I actually got that night. I tossed and turned, listening to the silent night until late morning when I finally rested my eyes. Well after daybreak, I got out of my tent and dragged my feet to pack my belongings. It was much later than I had aimed for the night before. I made it about 5 miles during the day, but it took me the entire afternoon until dark. I was tired, and it seemed, without having someone to push me along, my hiking was considerably slower. I pitched my tent that night, filtered water, and started setting up my cook gear in the dark. It was getting to feel pretty late, and with limited light to cook under, I decided to just eat a pack of raw ramen noodles in my tent. I opened my book to read, but only fell asleep immediately into another half-sleep, half-wrestling match for the night. I remember at one point staring at the top of my darkened tent, not really sure if I was awake or not, and suddenly hearing the loud crunch of footsteps outside my tent. They were fast going, as they came. But with the footsteps came something of a grumble. I couldn't be actually sure, and I couldn't distinguish any actual words, but in my mind's eye, I was sure I heard something grumbling to themselves in a deep and agitated voice. I never even got out of my sleeping bag. Not inexperienced with some of the sounds of the night and their magnification in the silence, I tried to convince myself that it was my ears playing tricks on me, and although I managed to stay in my sleeping bag that night, I didn't fall asleep again until early morning. The next day, I woke up even later and more tired than before. I made a groggy attempt at oatmeal and sat with my breakfast. I got my pack ready in the afternoon sun and headed out. About 3.5 miles later, I dropped my pack and sat watching the sun begin to disappear. I managed to collect a fair amount of firewood, and by the time nightfall came, I had a small fire going with a good collection of firewood piled beneath me. Under the reassuring light of the campfire, I started to become more at ease with the deafening silence of nature. I pulled a cigarette from my pocket and enjoyed a casual smoke as I put my feet up. When I tried to ditch the butt in my weakening flame, my throw was off and it landed outside the ashes. I got up to fix my mistake and to stoke the fire when I turned around to go back to my seat, and I saw him. The light was low with my little fire, but I could clearly see a man reaching down with a scorched hand for my firewood. He wore red plaid with large black burns tearing at his trim and a red ashy beard that smouldered at his face. He quickly looked up and his vacant white eyes connected with mine. He gritted his teeth and scrunched his nose towards me before quickly leaving the ring of firelight. I was shocked. I have never experienced a fear like it. I fell right onto my butt next to the flames. I looked out into the forest and saw nothing but dark shadows and unclear objects. A blank wall of nothing, of everything. I didn't know what to do. I didn't even yell, with no one to hear me but him. So I did what every red-blooded American would do. I packed up my things and got the hell out of Dodge. I stumbled through the darkness, half the time with my headlamp off, afraid to be seen or even of seeing anything else. I stumbled around for hours, bumping into trees and tripping every which way. I wasn't even sure where my map and compass was. I just kept moving. I could have been hiking in circles for all I know. I was driven by my beating heart, and to this day, I know I have never been so scared in my life. When dawn finally broke and I could see again, I kept moving. At about 12:30, I started to recognize some signs of civilization. I threw my pack down in a big open pasture, but couldn't see any houses or roads. I knew I had to be close to something, but I was by no means sure where I had ended up. I was almost too tired to think about it. Instead, in a fit of not knowing what to do, but knowing I had to do something, I pitched my tent and ate a large chunk of cheese and salami. After the meal and under the afternoon sun, I almost immediately fell asleep in the grass where I ate my lunch. I awoke 2 to 3 hours later, for the sun had dropped down considerably, and a funny smell filled my nostrils. I blinked a few times, and when the funny smell persisted, I shot off my back with my heart beating to the sound of something troubling. What I saw was my tent, or what remained of my tent. For now, the only thing left standing was the tent poles that dripped with oozing leftovers of my tent body. A bubbly layer of melted green plastic lay beneath the poles, with the steady grey smoke still rising from the mess. I got up and felt the weight of the sky fall on my head. For a moment, I was sure I had woken up in a horrible nightmare. Without contemplating it much further, I grabbed my water bottle and ran through the empty pasture. By the time I made it to the gravel road, I was out of breath and dripping with sweat. I hastily chugged from my water bottle and wiped my mouth. Down the road, I could see a vehicle parked in the dust. I staggered forward with my hands on my sides and soon realized it was a sheriff's sedan. And for the first time in a long time, I couldn't have been happier to see a law enforcement vehicle. When I got closer to the vehicle, I noticed that it was parked outside of the remains of a charred house. Nothing left standing but the mailbox out front. On the way into town, I didn't tell the officer about my experience, being afraid that he might think I'd escaped from the loony bin, and instead asked him about the burnt-down house that he had been parked in front of. The sheriff explained to me that 4 days prior, the same day I started my trip, the house had burnt down. They had no known cause, but there was indication of arson. 2 daughters, a wife and her husband, were all in the house when the fire started, and none of them made it out. Real tragic stuff, the sheriff said as he retold the story, and I could only shake my head with my bottom jaw hanging low. So this story doesn't sound like a ghost story, right? But the writer of the story had posted it as a ghost story. The tag was Appalachian Trail Ghost Story from the BlueRidgeOutdoors.com, right? And I think the implication is that this, whatever he saw, this man with the scorched hands and the scorched shirt and the smouldering beard, that whatever he saw was the cause of the fire and burnt his tent down, thinking potentially that he was in it. And now look, here's the thing, yet again, if this is supernatural or if this is bloody real life, it is equally terrifying. And he did write that this was his encounter with his true encounter with an Appalachian Trail ghost. And I think, God, we always say, you know, that real life encounters, as in with real human beings, are more terrifying because they can cause you such grievous injury. But apparently on the Appalachian Trail, ghosts can set you on fire. I also completely, I applaud anybody who goes camping on their own, because I like spending time on my own, right? I really do. I'm quite an insular person. But if you think I'm spending time on my own on a haunted ghost trail in the mountains that are full of mythical beasts in the middle of nowhere alone where things can set me on fire, absolutely not. I'll be on my own in my living room eating ice cream and watching Blown Away. And our final story today comes from phantomsandmonsters.com. My event was in the mid-80s and included my son and our dog Ginger. When we had our encounter, we were at a shelter on the Appalachian Trail in Amherst County. It was the Cow Camp Gap Shelter. It was early December and very cold. It would get below 10 degrees at night. I am comfortable in the woods, and teaching my son skills needed to survive, to me, is a life skill, like swimming. It's good father-son time. We arrived at the shelter shortly before dark, made a fire for warmth and hot food. The shelter faces south and has a spring-fed stream separating the shelter from the AT. The AT runs with an old narrow road separating and climbing north to the top of Coal Mountain. My son and I were in good spirits, talking and playing with Ginger. Ginger saw the figure coming out of the late twilight walking north. It was a surprise that anyone would be at that location, since the closest house was a hard 3 or 4 miles from the shelter. The figure came within 100 feet. The thing was tall and wore a dark brown fur coat. I was aware of Ginger's barking changing to something I had never heard from her before that event, nor after. Without thinking, I called out to the figure to come over and have some hot drink. That's when things got very difficult to explain. First, the creature turned to face us. Its face looked human in shape, but not human in appearance. It turned its whole body. When the creature looked at us is when Ginger's barking changed. Her hind legs appeared uncontrolled. Her sounds were not barking sounds, but a gurgling noise. She was in great pain. I momentarily focused on Ginger reaching down to her, which did not stop her suffering. I looked to the creature, who returned to continuing its long, athletic strides, taking it out of sight very quickly. Ginger resumed barking her aggression warning, but not the same as before that thing had turned to face us. My son said, "Dad, what just happened to Ginger?" I was thinking, what did that thing do to Ginger when it was 100 feet away? I was not fearful, and Ginger was a handful of golden retriever. We spent a cold night with Ginger at alert the entire time. When we made our way to the warmth of my car the next morning, Ginger curled up with my son in the back seat and slept the 3-hour drive home. I've since learned that area had a fall and winter, with dogs making a lot of noise at night, with a large number going missing. A calf went missing without a trace. The owner was uncommitted as to what was going on, but said his grandfather had a story about the brown man. He had not seen anything, but neighbors had. Something dreadful happened at that shelter in August of 2011. A hiker was found dead and half buried. It's now April 2016, and I've not heard of an arrest. I'm interested if there are any similar accounts of these things harming dogs. I'm a skeptic, looking for an explanation for Ginger's actions other than Bigfoot having mind control capability over dogs, and maybe humans too. And just to say that murder that the original poster references is a real murder. It was the murder of a person named Scott A. Lilly, who was 30 years old. I'm not going to go into the details of that murder because that's not what this podcast is about. But in the link to the original post, the website have gone and fact checked the murder and added the information and the details about that particular murder. I could not include a Bigfoot story in this episode. It would be wrong if I did this episode without including somebody's Bigfoot story. And look, there are Bigfoot stories from all over the Appalachian Trail. Bigfoot, Bigfeet, Bigfoots are all over there. They're all over that forest. Whatever they're doing, I don't know, but they're all over that forest. And this is such a strange and particular encounter with let's just call it Bigfoot because it's easier. So this father and son, they're out in the forest. They're used to being out in the forest. Their dog starts going crazy, barking at this creature that he says is like somebody in a fur suit. And then the dog is gurgling like it's in pain, which just sounds horrendous. I mean, nobody likes to think of their animal being in pain. That is such an awful thing to happen, especially if you are helpless and you can't do anything. It's not like the animal is stuck in a trap or has had a fall or has injured themselves. Something imperceivable is injuring your pet. You know what it is? I'd be sprinting and kicking that Bigfoot right in the face. I'm sorry. I call it animal abuse. I don't know. Call it cryptid abuse. But if I thought that Bigfoot was somehow with its mind injuring my dog, I would be roundhouse kicking that Bigfoot right in the jaw. I would spin its jaw. I mean, I absolutely wouldn't. I'd stand there terrified, petrified in fear, trying desperately to protect my animal. And actually, interestingly, this story reminded me of a story that somebody sent me a long time ago. It was a man who had called into maybe a podcast or some sort of like coast to coast type show. If anyone knows what it is I'm talking about, please do send me a link to it. But in this particular show, a man called up who claimed to have had experiences with Bigfoot. And initially I planned on doing an episode about it, but it was actually really distressing to listen to because this man was clearly, whatever had happened to him, I don't care whether it was an actual encounter with Bigfoot or whether he had had some sort of mental health episode, whatever it was, this man was clearly hideously impacted by what had happened to him. He was sobbing on the call. He was barely able to talk at some points. It was really distressing to listen to. But in it, he outlined that he had had these experiences with Bigfoot and that they possessed these powers to cause you great pain, like telepathically. And I just thought it was interesting that the same thing seems to be occurring in this story. I don't necessarily believe it. And what I mean by that is that I think original poster, if we are taking this post at face value, which we are for the purpose of this episode, I think they experienced something. Absolutely. That man who called in the radio show or the podcast, I don't remember which one it was, he experienced something. I think people who see Bigfoot, I think they are experiencing something. I just don't know what that something is. And here's the thing. Appalachia has it all. It's got Bigfoot. It's got ghosts. It's got ghost children. It's got fire ghosts. It's got things that can set your tent on fire while you're asleep in it. It's got things that are going to mind control you into oblivion. And I have to say, as an aside, I recorded this episode and then I came back and edited it and changed one of the stories and re-recorded sections of it. But in the interim where I had originally recorded the episode and then paused, I walked into town to meet some friends for dinner. But I decided in my infinite wisdom to walk through the pitch dark park and immediately regretted it. I had just recorded this episode and suddenly I was in the park in the dark, walking along on my own, and I was thinking, right, get ready. If a Bigfoot comes out of this bush up here, I'm going to punch it in the face straight into the river. And then I was thinking to myself, what if a fire ghost comes at me? And I don't usually think about stories after I've written them or recorded them. Usually I just kind of black it out and move on, you know. But the Appalachian ghost stories have clearly gotten under my skin. Thank you so much for listening to our first tentative dive into Appalachian folklore and ghost stories. If you would like to send in your story, you can do so by emailing it to reallifeghoststoriespodcast@gmail.com. You can also check out the website reallifeghoststoriespodcast.com. And if you are desperate for some extra content, you can subscribe to the Patreon. That is patreon.com/reallifeghoststories, where for $5 a month or $2 a month, you get access to heaps of extra content, as well as every single main and mini episode completely ad-free. And on that note, I shall see you next time.